he decided to marry her, and she decided to marry him. And it was a great combination. They were a wonderful couple together. One of the things that they decided to do very early in their marriage was that they would share their family traditions with each other. And so they came to the very first Easter. Now, they were both Christian, and they were both active in their own home churches. But the difference in Easter was that her family had a beautiful, large, gorgeous table and an Easter dinner. His family just never did that. And so together, the day before Easter, on that Saturday, they went to the grocery store, they picked out a beautiful ham, and all the trimmings, all the fixing, and the very next morning, before they went to worship, they were both up in the kitchen and getting the dinner ready to go. She got the ham out of the refrigerator, put it on the counter on a cutting board, got out a great big knife, and then, much to his confusion, for no reason whatsoever, she cut off the butt end of the ham and then turned it around and cut off the other end and then turned it sideways and trimmed the side and the side and then put it in the roaster and into the oven. He said, "Why did you do that?" She said, "Because that's how I was taught." "Doesn't your mom do that? My mom always taught me that you have to trim the ham." He said, "No, my mom never does that. It was a mystery." She said, "All I can do is tell you that's the tradition, and that's what my mom taught me." Well, months went past, and Christmas came. And they decided that they were going to have Christmas at her parents' place. And so, lo and behold, her mom decided it was time for ham dinner. He got up very early on Christmas morning to make sure to see what was happening, and lo and behold, she came into the kitchen, got out the roaster, pulled the ham out of the fridge, cut off the butt, cut off the head, and then turned it and trimmed the side, put it in the roaster in the oven, and he said, "Why do you do that?" She said, "Well, I've always done that. That's our tradition. That's how you make ham." And he said, "No, it's not. My family's never made ham like that." She said, "Well, you know, all I can tell you is that's the way my mom did it. That's our tradition." A few months later, they had a family reunion, and Grandma was going to be there. So he made sure that he was at the family reunion. Now, ham was not on the menu, but he still made sure that he had one-on-one quiet time with her just to help solve this family mystery. And he said to her, "That ham thing, what, trim, trim, turn, trim, trim, what is that? Do you do that?" And she said, "Oh, I've done that all of my adult life. Of course I do that." And he said, "Why?" "Oh," she said, "that's simple. My roaster's too small. The ham doesn't fit." Now, I want you to take that concept, and we are directly going to translate that into your faith. My roaster's too small, the ham doesn't fit. Every single one of us has a box in which we put God. Does there come a time in our lives where we have to say, "My box is too small, God doesn't fit"? My box is too small, God doesn't fit. Years ago, I was a mentor for one of our eighth grade confirmation kids, and I loved my time with Chance. During his eighth grade year, halfway through the year, we received notification that his grandfather had been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And Chance and I began praying for the life and the health and the strength of this wonderful, amazing grandfather up in Aberdeen. That cancer moved very quickly, and it was 4 months later that they celebrated his funeral. Let me tell you, you could just see the gears just flying in his head as he tried to figure this out. And we would talk about this in our mentoring sessions each week, and he said, "You're a pastor. You have a special connection to God, and yet Grandpa still died." And I prayed, and I prayed like I've never prayed for anybody before, and God still took my grandpa. Now, at that point, you can't just come out and say, oh, come on, that's not the way it is. No, 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 no. This was very real, because Chance, in effect, said to me, look, I did everything I was supposed to. I followed all the rules, and this is what happened, the worst. So the result is either there is no God, or there is a God who hates me and was punishing me for something. And so we continued our conversations, and I don't know how effective I was, but what I wanted to say is, Chance, buddy, your box is too small, and God doesn't fit in that. Is it possible that there was a third option? Instead of saying there is no God, or there is a God and that God is punishing me, is there another option that in a larger way said there is a God, and that God walks with you when the worst things in life happen? Chance, how do we make your box bigger? This is what I give to you today. There are times in each of our lives when our box is too small. Now, every single one of us has a box in which we understand God. We have to, because our brains are so small in comparison to this reality that is the universe and that is our creating God. And so what that means is that we have ways in which we understand. This is who God is, and this is what God does, and this is how God works. And when something happens in our lives that challenges that, that says there's more, that can be very disorienting. It can be very difficult to say, ah, my box is too small, and God doesn't fit. I love it when I get to have conversations with some of my friends who are agnostic or atheist. Now, these conversations don't happen very often, and I hope that you get to have some of these conversations too, because these conversations have taught me more about my own faith and my own understanding of God than almost any other conversation. Usually when they happen, a lot of times they just don't know that I'm a pastor, because that can be very, very threatening. Am I just going to flip that right back, anything that they say right back at them and shove God down their throats? No, no, no. You have to listen very carefully. And a lot of times then what this conversation will be is when they say, I don't know that I can believe in God. And what I try to ask is the question, can you tell me about the God that you don't believe in? And the answer is something like this. Look, I can't believe in a God that allows the starvation and the killing of small children through hunger. I can't believe in a God that sends tsunamis and tornadoes and hurricanes to kill innocent people. I can't believe in a God that allows all of the death and destruction through war and natural disaster. I can't believe in that God. And my response, as gently as I can, is to say, I don't believe in that God either. I believe in a God that is love. I believe in a God that walks with us. Not a God that causes this. Not a God that is reaching down a thunderbolt to smite us. I believe in a God who walks with us. What happens when our box is too small and God doesn't fit? What happens when we try to enlarge that box? Now, my friends, I have laid the foundation for the letter, Paul's letter to the Galatians. Let me tell you about the Apostle Paul and what he was doing in this letter. Paul was figuring out how to serve those communities that were the earliest Christians. It was all about serving. The Apostle Paul was not born with the name Paul. He was born with the name Saul. He was born in the northeast quadrant of the Mediterranean Sea in a seaboard community that was called Tarsus. He was born as a Jew among Jews. His parents were Jewish. His grandparents were Jewish. His great-great-great-great-grandparents were Jewish. Circumcised on the eighth day, he was raised inside of Jewish teachings. The Sabbath was holy every Friday night when the sun went down, and he was put into school. By approximately the time he was 15 years old, Paul had memorized the entire Old Testament, word for word. This was the schooling process that young Jewish men went through. He eventually came down from Tarsus, down into Jerusalem. There, he began to study with the rabbi, Gamaliel. Gamaliel was a very traditional, very conservative, very strong, very popular rabbi in that community. And Paul learned. Now, Saul was present in the earliest moments of the Christian movement. He actually would have been in Jerusalem at the same time that Jesus at times was. To the best of my knowledge, the two of them never met. But what I know is that Jesus was illegally killed. He was crucified. He died, was put in the grave, was resurrected. And this early Jewish movement became Christian. They referred to themselves as followers of the way. Jesus was more or less, approximately, 15 years older than Paul. When the early church movement started, one of the things that happened was that early evangelists began to pop up. One of those evangelists was Stephen. Stephen eventually was brought before the Jewish governing council, the Sanhedrin, and was found guilty basically of blasphemy, and they took him out and they stoned him. Saul was the young man, the teenager, who was present at that stoning and stood there holding their coats as they stoned Stephen. He was in on the ground level. And he went from there to grow in power and strength, and he became the number one persecutor of the early Christian way. Anybody and everybody who was Christian inside of Jerusalem was in danger of being sniffed out by Saul and brought into punishment. Well, there came a day when Saul said, "Let me go to Damascus." And so the Sanhedrin gave him permission to go from Jerusalem down to or up to Damascus, where there was a center of Christianity that was growing. On the way, Saul had a face-to-face encounter with the living Christ. As he was on the road, he was struck down by a blinding light. He was blinded, and in that moment of blinding, there was a voice that came and said, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And Saul said, "Who are you?" And the voice said, "I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting." This was the moment of change for Saul. But change is just the beginning, because from there it takes transition. Saul went up to Damascus. One of the early disciples, a man named Ananias, had the courage to come to pray and to lay hands, and Paul received his sight back. And he began preaching very early. He began preaching to be able to say, "We believe in Jesus the Christ." But it took time. I want you to see what just happened. Inside of this conversion moment, Paul went from being the number one persecutor to the number one promoter of Christianity, because in that moment, he realized his box was too small and God didn't fit. He didn't get a larger box. Saul's box was exploded. And he needed time to figure this out. And so he went out into the Arabian desert for 3 years where he began to sort and to focus and to re-grasp an understanding of who God was and how God works. And he came back and he started preaching. When you heard those words in Galatians today, Paul had been now out and preaching for over a decade, out in the hinterlands. And as he was preaching, he preached to anyone and everyone to say, you need Jesus Christ. You need to be following God through this Christ. He had the audacity to talk with women, and not just to talk with them, to work with him. A lot of times we will accuse Paul of being a misogynist. We will accuse Paul of being one who didn't like to work with women. In reality, if you will look closely, what you'll discover is that Paul worked with women all the time in very powerful ways. He worked with Gentiles. His calling card was to go into a new community. He would find the synagogue, the Jewish synagogue, worship with them, and then as he began to preach, immediately began to go outside those walls and pull in the Gentiles. And the Gentiles began to grow this movement. It was amazing to watch what happened because Paul was able to recognize that his box was too small, and that his version of God did not fit. And this drove the early Christian leaders, as well as the original Jewish leaders, absolutely crazy. Absolutely. It just frustrated them to have to work with Paul because Paul was so far outside of their box. And so Paul, after 14 years, came down out of the Northlands, back into Jerusalem, and met with these leaders, with Peter, John, James, the brother of Jesus. And he said to them, you're going to go preach to the Jews. That's where God has called you. But I'm going to go preach to the Gentiles because that's where God has called me. And he had to prove to them that this was a reality. And finally, those early disciples said, okay, we'll allow it, because do you see what this meant? No circumcision, no food, no rules about clothing, no rules about food, no Jewish rules. And John and Peter and James said, all right, we'll allow that. This was huge. Paul did this through service. Always going into new communities, working, serving. He was a tent maker. Working and serving, serving and working. This is what we do. How do you make your box bigger? How do you change boxes? Well, what I want to tell you today is, first of all, I want to give you permission to recognize what happens when your box is too small and God doesn't fit anymore. It's okay to get a bigger box. It's okay to just blow the sides out of that box. And the way that we do that is through service. We help one another. We teach one another. When you're watching Drew and Linnea up here, when you're watching Theo and Olivia and these little hands that are learning, this is what service is all about. We teach each other. We help each other. We grow together. I want to invite Janelle to come because I want to show you one of the ways that we powerfully do this inside of our own congregation. For those of you who have not met her, I want to introduce Janelle Jones to you. Janelle has been one of the servant leaders in our congregation for decades. And one of the things that we do together is to work in what is called congregational care ministry. In this church, I love to be able to say, I do not do pastoral care. We together do congregational care. This is one of the most powerful ways that we expand our concepts of who God is and how God works. Janelle, would you please help us and explain what is congregational care ministry and how does that work inside of our congregation?
I'll start with a little history lesson. Mary Hyenga had heard this idea of what they were doing in Church of the Resurrection down in the Kansas City area. And so three of us, Chris Davis, Mary and I, traveled down there for a training session, and they're a very large church. And when we came back with that training, we figured out ways to adapt it and how we could work with our pastor. The idea of congregational care is that we as laity are all in it together to help with care of the congregation. It's important for people to realize that we are not there to substitute for a pastor or take his place or be instead of. We are working with and supportive and together. Our particular team meets twice a month, and it's a very special sharing time, an important prayer time, so that we can bring each other up to date and say, well, did you know that this elderly person has fallen, or somebody's in the hospital, or somebody is needing care, or changed residences, and those kind of things. We have a lot of different aspects of our congregational care, and some are on the actual team, and some are the rest of the congregation that are auxiliary to that. We have people that deliver the CDs to those that aren't able to come to worship. We have four different teams that take communion out so that if people are not able to attend worship, if you knew of someone that wasn't able to come regularly for worship and be able to be here when we have communion, contact the church office and let us know that you would desire that kind of thing. We work with the health ministry team on another number of projects and the group that does caring meals and just a lot of ways that we are all working together to help support our congregation.
It's very, very hands-on. It is completely serving-oriented, and it is all about how can we serve others in our congregation. And when you have the faith of Jesus Christ in your hands, and you are reaching out with your own hands in service to others, it makes your box bigger. Well, Janelle, you're not just on the leadership team. You are very, very involved in the care itself. So tell me, what is your favorite part of congregational care ministry? What gives you joy?
Well, a number of things give me joy, so it's hard to narrow it down, but I take communion to the nursing home, so that's a very special kind of ministry. Pastor goes to both the nursing home and Edgewood Vista, one of our assisted living places, to do worship at least once a month and sometimes more. And whenever possible, I try to attend those as well. And it gives me an opportunity to just be with the people and find those groups that I'm able to visit with or touch base periodically that are residing there. So those are part of it. I think the team meetings are also very special because of that time for prayer and the camaraderie of knowing that there are others that are doing this with us and that we meet regularly. We are there twice a month, almost always, to be able to touch base and to support each other in the kinds of ministry.
This is a constant process. And here's what's so brilliant about this. You are part of congregational care ministry. There are times when we have no idea that you just took cinnamon rolls over to your neighbor who had been sick or sad that week. We didn't know you did that, but that is congregational care ministry when you participate. Well, we want you to know that you are invited into even different levels, greater levels of this, all the way from that team that meets around the table out into every piece of care. If someone here today said, I would really like to become involved with some level of congregational care inside of our church, how would they do that? What would that look like?
Well, they certainly could visit with the pastor or me if they know me. Another option would be that Chris Davis is really our kind of team captain and keeps things organized. She takes very careful notes each time when we have a meeting, so we're aware. Did you and I know that Joanne Cleveland has moved to a different residence and isn't so readily able to be in worship? That's an example. You know, we know and care about Joanne, and we can reach out to her.
Yeah, yeah. Janelle, thank you.
I want to mention other thing about communion. Sometimes you may notice that there's the little bottle of grape juice that's up here, and that's so that we bless the communion elements that will be taken out. Some of the teams go on Sunday, some on Monday, or during the week. So right after we have had communion as a worshiping congregation, it's made available to people that are not able to be here.
Yeah. So there it is.
There it is.
Thank you, Janelle. Thank you. There are moments in our lives when our box is just too small and God doesn't fit anymore. This is common. This is growth. How you believed in God when you were 3 years old is much different than when you were 13 and when you are 23, 33, 53, 83. It's much different as our boxes change. This is not just a confusing time. It can also be a very, very joyful time. It can be a time when we realize that in service to others, that we can grow as our concept of God grows. This is the invitation that says, all right, my friends, are you ready to grow? In Jesus' name, may you know that there are times when your box is too small and God just doesn't fit. Amen. Would you pray with me? So Lord of love and Lord of life, we pray that you would help us as we believe in you, this never-changing God. But Lord, our understanding of you changes. So Lord, help us to grow always with every day of our life, to grow in love and service.